I'd like to welcome you to the session entitled, What Drives the Doomsday Machine? How the Unthinkable Becomes the Inevitable. For those of you who were not here yesterday, my name is Peter Kildee. For those of you who were here yesterday, my name is Joe Flint. No, my name remains Peter Kildee. Our topic today is quite a little bit different than the topic yesterday. Yesterday we dealt, if you recall, mostly in relatively straightforward and empirical data. We had numbers, everybody more or less agreed on them, we could spell them out on the blackboard and describe a few terms and let those facts sort of speak for themselves. Our topic today is a little bit more difficult to pursue. It's laid out on a rather alien and tricky landscape. Some of the concepts are emotional, some are irrational. It's a little difficult. I hope I can guide us through it and have some understanding. Once again, I hope to be able to do this and still have a little time left over at the end for questions. If we don't get to that, and you see me around anywhere in the village, I'm certainly more than happy to talk anytime about any of these issues. Okay, I'd like to summarize very briefly what we did last time. We talked about the hair-triggered Holocaust. We discovered that there were 53,000 nuclear warheads in the world right now, that 52,000 of them were shared between the Russians and ourselves, with 1,000 shared by the other members of the nuclear club. This is an allotment of 3 tons of TNT per person. And we learned a little bit about counterforce and launch-on warning and the first strike. All of these are what makes the system hair-triggered. One of the things that we talked about after laying out some of these was a brief description of some upcoming missile systems. The Trident submarine system, the cruise missile system for two, and the MX, all of which amounts to approximately 15,000 more strategic warheads by the year 2000, by the year 1990. The two numbers you see on the blackboard off to your right, the number on your left, 53,000, is the present. The 90,000 on your right is the projected number of warheads, estimated number of warheads, on the planet by the year 2000. Should we last so long, I'd like to point out that the Soviets still only have 218 cities with a population of 100,000 or more. A couple things I'd like to say about the MX. That's kind of where we left off, and it works out to be a rather nice bridge into our session today. We talked a little bit about the monstrosity of the system, just what an enormous undertaking this weapon system is. Pointed out that it would take up 24,000 square miles of land, require 10,000 miles of superhighway, use about 25% of all of our cement-producing capacity in the country. These things would be dragged around on million-pound trucks, all these staggering statistics. And that they would amount to 200 missiles with a total of 2,000 new warheads in 4,600 shelters. You remember all the numbers? I don't expect everybody to remember the specific numbers, but it's a rather amazing system. Okay, last night after the session, I talked to Tom Witt a little bit, and he said, I got something in the mail today you should see. And when I looked it over, I thought, well, I think this could be real handy for the session today. You see that? You see what it says? I'll read it to you. More MX is needed, study says. What I'd like to do is just read this article to you and talk about it just a little bit, because it's a pretty good case study for how the arms race works and why it perpetuates itself. This is from the Chicago Tribune. A congressionally ordered study warns that the United States would need to triple the number of missiles and launching silos the Pentagon says it now wants if the country is to match the likely Soviet threat. Okay? So all that we were getting excited about yesterday, they have come up with a study that says, well, we'll need to do 3 times that. I alluded to that yesterday when I talked about this system for all of its expense being obsolete by early 1990s and at the latest by the year 2000. Well, they've solved that problem in typical arms race fashion. They're planning or suggesting that we're going to need 3 times as many silos, which would add another ding, 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 4,000 or 5,000 warheads, all right, to this whole mess. Reading on, even the current plan to base 4,600 silos and 200 MX missiles in Nevada and Utah has met with fierce opposition from the ranchers, environmentalists, and politicians. White House officials have expressed concern, too, over the enormous cost of the plan, a minimum of at least $40 billion. And that's their estimate. We talked about some other groups, the General Accounting Office, for example, estimating up to $60 billion and lifetime expense of about $100 billion. While President Reagan wrestles with the plan for 200 missiles and 4,600 silos, the Congressional Office of Technological Assessment, the OTA, forecasts in a report for Thursday release that the country will likely need 550 of the expensive missiles and 12,500 shelters by the year 1995 to meet the Soviet threat if the MX is based in multiple silos. All right. A couple of things going on here. It's relatively subtle. I don't want to make an extra big point of it. In the first paragraph, it's a likely Soviet threat. In the third paragraph, it is a Soviet threat. Okay? And a little bit more concrete. It gets a little bit more concrete as you go along. The OTA study abounds with grim assessments for the future in preparing a national defense against the growing Soviet nuclear arsenal. Reagan's decision on the MX and other nuclear weapons is expected late this month. Okay. An OTA news release summarizing the study concludes, OTA found that if the Soviets continue to expand their forces at the same rate as they did in the 1970s, yes. Too fast? Okay, I will slow. Okay, I can do all these things. How's this? Okay. Yeah, feel free to throw that in. I'll be happy to slow down. They found that if the Soviets continue to expand their forces at the same rate as they did in the 1970s, a system of 200 missiles and 4,400 decoys hidden amongst 4,600 shelters would be too small. To assure the survival of 100 MX missiles, 360 missiles hidden in 8,250 shelters would be required by 1990, and 500 missiles in 12,500 shelters would be required by 1995. What about the year 2000 or 2010? They don't carry it any farther than that at this point, but they certainly give no reason to believe that anything is going to be any different in 1995. Very important thing to remember. Okay, the study estimated that the cost that would cost in excess of $82 billion to build an MX system that large. I would bet a month's wages that they wouldn't be able to do it for twice that. roughly half of this year's entire and record total expense outlay. Okay, now this gets a little complicated, but I'm going to continue on a bit. It points out some of the fallacies in this system. The scientific team hired by Congress to conduct the study analyzed 5 alternatives suggested in recent years to base the new generation of MX missiles. The Pentagon insists the MX is needed because today's 1,053 Minutemen and Titan missiles are believed to be vulnerable to a preemptive Soviet attack. And serious drawbacks were cited for each of the 5 alternatives. Basically, in summary, what they do is they talk about the need for another system we talked about yesterday, which is what I call launch under attack, which reads like this. The policy would require a launch under attack the instant a new and expensive system of satellites and computers detected a Soviet attack. That's kind of a frightening word, the instant. We talked yesterday about 15 minutes or 17 minutes or half an hour. They're talking about a system where this whole thing would be poised and ready to snap. It's something that, again, we'll be getting to a little bit more detail very soon. One of the things that this report included here, something that's a little kind of humorous, but it's ridiculous, too. The study includes such details as the uncanny similarity between the signals given by swimming whales and enemy submarines on Navy sonar sets. Again, you're talking about a system in which there's very little room for error. You've got snap judgments going on there. Okay, there are a few other problems with this whole thing. One is they're talking about defending it with a ABM system, which is anti-ballistic missiles, okay? Problem with an ABM system is that they're relatively unreliable at this state, they concluded that, and that they would have to spend $15 billion to do it. Okay, well, I'm not going to spend any more time going over all of this. It's very important to note, I think, just some of the central concepts. You get the system going, you put things in place, someone comes up with a weakness in the system, you solve that by creating a larger problem. This has been the history of the arms race for many years. The whole issue here is survivability. And I'd like to read a little bit of something on survivability, too, before we continue. I mentioned yesterday a man by the name of J. Edward Anderson. He's at the Institute of Technology at the University of Minnesota. And he's written quite a bit on missile systems and how this all works. Finally, he's gotten a couple articles published in Strategy, which is this journal, and a couple other magazines. He's beginning to have quite an impact on the profession. I heard a man just before I left say that he was probably the strongest voice in the world right now in questioning the whole idea of vulnerability. And I've got a first draft of one of his papers here, and I was going through it last night. And he does just an excellent job of debunking that whole thing. I could explain that at length, but it would take the whole time. His conclusion, I think, is worthy of note. He says, the whole concept of vulnerability of land-based ICBMs to attack by other ICBMs fails to stand up under detailed examination. As a result of the problems of reliability, accuracy, fratricide is nuclear warheads knocking out each other. And when you're talking about mass attacks, that becomes very important. He demonstrates quite well that you'd have to launch in waves, which would give people time to respond in waves. The surprise attack is not going to work. The launch on warning possibilities, simultaneity, which is another concept we didn't talk about, which is to say, all right, this is kind of fun. If they are in the process of sending their missiles to the United States, okay, all the way over the world, we've got a 20-minute lead time there to we see them, all right? We fire off our Pershings in Western Europe that land there in 5 minutes. Okay, well, how do you deal with that? Well, you attack the Pershings first, right? Then we've got about 20 minutes after that attack to launch all of our missiles back again. Very subtle system in a way, but under a little bit of analysis, again, it breaks down. It does not work. The whole system does not work. Okay. The perception that a first strike is possible must be dispelled by knowledge, just as the fear of witches in Salem was eventually dispelled by knowledge. No nation can afford to develop its policies based on fear and ignorance. A much greater effort than at present must be made to understand the problems faced by the Soviet Union, and indeed by ourselves and all nations, if our children are to have any reasonable kind of future. We cannot continue to allow fear to deprive us of reason. We must enormously increase the effort to find practical ways to solve conflicts without resort to violence. His final line, I think, is interesting. Kind of comes out of the blue. He said, rising interest in these issues on the part of churches is a hopeful sign and must be encouraged and continued. Right. Take that to note a little bit. Okay. What I'd like to do just a little bit in preparation for this understanding of how all this keeps rolling, okay? Why do we keep moving towards the abyss in the fashion that we are? I'd like to refer people a little bit back to John Schramm's session last night, if you attended it. How many people attended that? talked about the Club of Rome and Global 2000. All right, this is an age of tremendous need. We have huge problems out there, and the way we're addressing them and the kind of energies that it takes to deal with that are not forthcoming, largely because of this particular aspect of the arms race. I think it's very important when we think of all of this to put it in the context of other things that are happening in the world. Right now, over half of the physicists and engineers in the world are employed by the military, directly or indirectly. And though a lot of this is building bridges and taking care of people, ultimately the purpose of it is largely around newer and better ways to kill people in larger numbers. According to the United Nations, the world's governments spend on the welfare of their children every year what they spend on the military every 2 hours. Okay. Right now, 500 million of God's children are needlessly starving to death. There have been many studies on the World Hunger Program that have come out relatively recently, which demonstrate that there is ample food. It's not a matter of an unsolvable problem by any means, a matter primarily of resource allocation and systems. In 1978, the United States military budget was $112 billion. At that time, only 8 nations in the world could boast of that much total income. That's just our defense. In a world rich enough to spend $550 billion a year on an oversupply of military power, one person in three lives in painful poverty. Okay, well, that's just a little bit of a background setting for the next step, which is what I've called the realm of paradoxes, ironies, and madness. It gets a little hairy, and I would like almost to apologize for some of the kind of words that appear in this section, but I just frankly don't see that there are any other words that apply. The military is noted for speaking very casually about acceptable losses when what they're talking about is the incineration or horrible death of millions and millions of people. I think horrible needs to be called horrible and madness needs to be called madness. Right now, it is apparent that the world is moving swiftly, surely, and at great expense towards a nuclear war that nobody wants. The Stockholm Peace Studies Institute has concluded that at some point in the first half of the 21st century, the probability of an all-out nuclear war will be one. If you know anything about probabilities, what they're saying there is a certainty. Now, once again, like the Club of Rome, this is not a prediction so much as it is a following of trends. You know, what's going on, how the arms race is escalating, how systems are changing, how proliferation is complicating the matter, making it much more likely that you've got people who are not in agreement or other types of forces, which we will get into, contributing their part to this. It also must be noted that the gamble we are taking here against long odds is at best an unending arms race with its devastating social, economic, spiritual, and psychological cost, and at worst, very possibly the end of all life on the planet. Now, it's hard to conceive of that, which is one of the major problems with dealing with the issue. It's not a certainty that nothing will survive. It's been pointed out, I'm sure you've heard, that cockroaches are 400,000 times as resistant to radiation as humans. Frankly, I take almost no comfort from that. Norman Cousins, just evoking a little imagery here once again to try and understand this a little bit, Norman Cousins says that the United States and the USSR are like two men trying to see who can chop the biggest hole in the boat they're both riding in. Okay? It's not so far out as you might think. You have to step back a little bit from the arguments and look at the hole, and that's sort of what it looks like. Personally, I think Helen Caldicott
described it a little better. She's a pediatrician who is the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a remarkable woman. And she puts it like this. She said, "We are like a baby playing with a live hand grenade, fascinated by the shiny pin." I think there are a number of things in that imagery which start to give the flavor of this nuclear arms race and of what its consequences may be. I sincerely wonder who has the right to take those kind of gambles. What does this say in a very ultimate sense about our stewardship and about where we put our trust and where we put our faith? So, what drives the doomsday machine? Try and figure that out. Let's look at one thing, the will of the people. It's a possibility. It looks like we'll have 90,000 warheads by the year 2000, and that these warheads will be launched by computers without any human intervention. Who here would like to see that happen? Informal poll. Okay, that's not what you want, huh? How many people here think that we have enough nuclear weapons as it is and would like to see an immediate freeze? Very good. You win. Actually, this is not quite so hokey as it sounds. You probably wouldn't be here if you didn't have that opinion. But in a major national poll this summer, they found out that 78% of the people in the country shared the same view. They said we have enough and were in favor of an immediate and unilateral freeze on nuclear weapon development. So, it's certainly not the will of these people anyway. One thing that starts to become evident when we look at this is that the American people are not consulted about these things. It's all after the fact. We always have to accept and relate to these after they're already thrust upon us by some other mechanism. A good example is the bomb in Hiroshima. Nobody knew we were even developing it. I've yet to hear anybody explain how we were better off by not getting the word out. We defeated the Germans. The Japanese were virtually defeated. Who in the world were we keeping it secret from? I don't know. And I've also yet to hear any decent rationalization for dropping it on a city. If we were trying to just show them that we had this super weapon, we could have dropped it anywhere and demonstrated that we had it. It's a little bit more sinister than that. Hiroshima was unbombed during the last part of the attack on Japan. And the reason it was unbombed is it was being left as a target so that they were sure that the effects that they could then note would be the effects of their new super weapon and not any confusing data from earlier bomb raids. The city was pristine when that bomb was dropped. The development of the hydrogen bomb is even more interesting. It was developed in 1953 at a time when there was no need for it at all, period. Nobody else had it. Nobody else was working on it. During that time, again, the American people were not consulted, and the entire scientific board of the advisory board to the Atomic Energy Commission voted against going ahead with it. They went ahead with it anyway. It's also interesting to note that every president since Eisenhower has most eloquently warned of the horrors of nuclear war while simultaneously doing their bit to escalate the arms race. Again, quoting John Kennedy, "Mankind must do away with war, or war will do away with mankind," referring specifically to nuclear war. I was very excited when Jimmy Carter was running for office. He was including in his platform a promise to work to abolish nuclear weapons, to reduce the military expenditures, and eventually to, you know, his goal was zero nuclear weapons in the world. What an exciting idea. Very, very excited. Jimmy Carter, in reality, ordered the production of the cruise missiles, which we talked about yesterday, the MX missile, and continued all major research and development programs, increased the military budget. Now, I personally believe that Jimmy Carter sincerely wanted to reduce the threat of nuclear war. I don't think the man was necessarily a liar. But for some reason, it certainly didn't happen, and it hasn't happened with anybody else. My senior pastor back in Minneapolis has said something a couple of times which is so simple, it's very obvious, but at the same time, I think it's almost profound when it relates to this issue. He says that we get where we are not by the goals we set, but by the roads we travel down. And one of the things that you find out when you start getting into this nuclear war issue is that there is rhetoric all over the place and stated policies all over the place which sound terrific. Henry Kissinger, in his document to the SALT II, Senate SALT II Committee, makes great eloquent statements about how any leader who was at all responsible in this age certainly could not advocate any policies which might increase the likelihood of nuclear war, da-da-da-da-da, and then goes right ahead with this phenomenal rationalization for the MX and all these other systems and for a great increase in our military strength. So, ultimately, you have to look at systems and what actually appears in a three-dimensional corporal form. So, once again, we get back to the question, what drives the doomsday machine? What keeps this thing rolling? The simple answer is that there isn't anybody driving the machine. The bus has no driver. And in one sense, that's true. There simply is no single government or power or person or entity of any kind who is perpetuating this course of events. I tried pretty hard to come up with some kind of an image that would convey how this is really working. The one I've came up with may not be the best. The next group that hears talk by me on this subject may get a better image, I'm not sure. But the way I was conceiving of it, the way I'd like to try and picture it for you, is it's like a log rolling down a road, okay? Flat road. The road leads to a ditch. The ditch is the abyss. Flames leaping over the edge. Okay. Nobody wants to go there. The log is rolling along, being pushed by an uncoordinated and semi-structured team of forces, team of people. The nice thing about the analogy is that it does explain kind of how things work. You don't have to have, you know, there's not any one force that is propelling this or not. When somebody is slacked off, somebody else is pushing. All right. If everybody slacks off by some miracle, the thing still has a little bit of inertia and rolls on its own. You've got tremendous structures backing it up. You've got tremendous forces behind it. And it just keeps on going. Now, what I've tried to do is label a few of these, few of the members of this particular team, right? The team that's moving this thing along. And, again, it's just a little bit tricky. They overlap quite a bit. They are related to each other, though they are all a little bit different. The first one that I'd like to isolate is fear. Now, fear is an interesting thing because it is both rational in some instances and irrational in others. It all feels the same. And one thing about fear is that it looks for an object.
Now, that doesn't do that much all by itself, but it plays into some other systems. One of the main systems that it plays into is political expediency. Okay? The idea that you give people somebody to hate and they'll love you for it. It's a simple reduction of the problem. Fear is somewhat of a state of being for many people, for a lot of people, for all of us at some times in our lives. And when you have a politician get up and say something like, Soviet aggression is responsible for every hot spot on the globe today? Does that sound at all familiar to anyone? Okay, that's Ronald Reagan running for office this year. Very simple solution, there's one enemy. Recall I said the same thing about inflation, government spending, period. My economics professor at the university said that, you know, if you ever hear anybody tell you that there is one cause for inflation, the man is a liar or a charlatan or a fool. So I'm looking at this guy, don't know what it is. Another part of political expediency, another one of these major drawing forces, is that you have a responsibility to getting reelected to your constituency. One weapon system, which I'm aware of, the F-18 fighter plane, relatively small fighter plane that's just been built, had contracts in 44 states. There was not a senator or a representative on the House to oppose it. That's true of many of these weapon systems, and it's part of what drives this machine. Mm-hmm. Another very important concept here, and probably the most difficult to wrestle with, most difficult to try and convey, is something that Albert Einstein alluded to a number of years ago. He said, this is a paraphrase, I couldn't find the quote, if the explosion of the first nuclear weapon, everything changed except mankind's mode of thought. I'm going to read that again, because that is very, very close to a major motivator, a major engine behind this machine. If the explosion of the first nuclear weapon, everything changed except mankind's mode of thought. Now, last night when John Sram was talking a little bit, he mentioned the word unprecedented and gave a relatively stern warning about using this word. I'm very careful. So I thought about it very hard last night and today, and I'm going to call the situation unprecedented. Never before in 3 million years of conflict resolution have we been in a situation where the big guy, the strong guy, the powerful team, cannot win. And that cannot win. And that simply is an extraordinary challenge for what? The inertia behind our human relationships. We've got people trained in military victory, in winning wars, in strategies that win wars. They're having a terrible time with this particular issue. I've seen some films on war games and things that are almost comical. They're almost comical. It's trying to get the people who play the Soviets to launch an attack. They won't do it. There's no reason to do it. There's no rational reason to do it. So they have to force the issue. Okay? Okay, we'll start with the assumption. And then they can play their game. Generally, they find out that if you're talking about acceptable losses, you're talking about losses, again, in the many millions of people. Right. One of the biggest problems with this is that our traditional way of understanding enemies and opposition breaks down. The enemy is no longer the other side, though they may be our adversaries. The enemy is the weapon. It's much more of a threat. The weapon is much more of a threat than just about any reasonable contingency from the other side. That's another discussion, too, a little bit, the Russian threat and what that means, for example. But for right now, at least I think most of us would admit that to have our nation virtually obliterated by nuclear weapons is a bigger problem than anything the Russians could do to us. If you don't agree with that, that's another threat. Okay. Fourth major dynamic behind here is what I'm calling misinformation. And what these are false assumptions, misperceptions, ignorance, half-truths, and lies. All of which comes from different sources. They're very much a part of this whole ballgame. I'm going to tie that back to fear just for a moment. Again, the mind in a state of fear, looking for an object,
will grab on for a half truth, grab on to what it wants to believe very readily. And if you have people or forces, or by forces I don't mean anything weird or cynical, I'm just trying to summarize profit-making industries and the position-seeking generals and politicians who are right down the line. I'm not being a cult here. But if there are forces out there that are promoting this point of view and your mind is right for it, it's very easy to buy into something like, we have to have a strong defense. Right? And this means spending a great deal more money. Okay? When the reality is a little different, the reality is I've got a 45 point at Steve's head, he's got a 38 point at my head, and we are both equally dead. Okay? Doesn't make any difference. If I say, we got a pistol gap coming up here, and it looks like he's going to have, well, don't get it bigger, I should have started smaller. Okay, I've got a 32, it looks like he's going to get a 38, I need a 45. It's ridiculous at that point. We cross that line, that thinking line, when we hit the term overkill. Now, overkill is a word subject to a concept of reification. And a concept doesn't exist, you come up with a word, and then go back and create the reality for the word. Are you familiar with that process? We're going to do quite a bit of that in the last couple decades. Okay. One of the false assumptions relates to a lot of the information I gave you yesterday. You develop these systems, you think they're going to work, okay? So you really bank on them. And you think you've got an error probability of about, 99%. You really sure you can knock out that target, then you push the button. That's a false assumption at this point. J. Edward Anderson's paper does a very good job of debunking that. There are many problems that that system does not deal with. Okay. I can't really go into that, but the belief that system is going to work, even if it's misinformation, can lead to reaction. It does promote the strategy of winning a war, for example. Right. The next thing, it's a major factor, and a few things fall out under it. It's something that Dr. Frank Barnaby, the director of the Stockholm Institute for Peace Studies, calls the military, industrial, academic, bureaucratic complex. Now, we all remember the military-industrial complex from Eisenhower's farewell speech, a very strong warning against the permanent military industry, the permanent defense industry. We did not heed that warning, and boy, are we in trouble. Since that time, there's been a tremendous emphasis placed on research and development. That's where the academic comes in. The bureaucratic works like this. Right now, there are 26 million men in uniform in the world. There are approximately 26 million bureaucrats administering the program for those 26 million men. There's a tremendous influence on people's jobs and security and promotions and all the kind of things. One thing about the Pentagon is that it is a huge entity, right? It is a huge bureaucracy. The latest figures I could get here at Holden, I didn't have a chance to get some of my stuff with me, but I've got 1977 figures on the Pentagon, and here's how they read. $228 billion in wealth. To point out that this year's Pentagon budget is $322 billion. Give you an idea of how things are escalating. Okay. It owns more land than the six smallest states in the country put together. It has more wealth than the 15 largest companies in the country and the 15 largest utilities. Right. That's just in and of itself. Lobbyists all over the place. Okay. It's also got 22,000 prime contractors and 100,000 subcontractors out there very anxious to lap up some of this money, okay? And it does go into the, eventually it comes out into somebody's industry. So I've listed a few things that fall out under this complex. And I'll just read through them. Greed is one. Very high profits in the military industry. And they make no bones about it. They tell you, well, it just has to be like this because it's so specialized, you know? I don't know what that has to do with it. non-competitive bidding, enormous profit. I heard a guy suggest once that, you know, you hear a lot of this patriotism talk from the defense industry. Okay, if that's the most important thing, let's have them do it at cost. Another very important thing that falls out under this is the idea of compartmentalization and myopia. Basically, it's limiting yourself to your little piece of the action, okay? Your little cog. It can be quite large. You can be producing Honeywell guidance systems for MX missile, for example. Or it can be very small, a little industry out in Wisconsin, cranking out plastics for, you know, some part of the town. Yeah, any number of things. Okay, the problem is all these little parts add up to this machine that we've been describing, which is liable to kill everybody. Okay. The myopia is lack of recognition of that fact. Do not take that into account. I've tied that in a little bit with irresponsibility. Irresponsibility, I've taken a look at in two ways. One is acceptable losses in tens of millions. I say that is irresponsible. I don't give anybody the power to make that kind of decision. But perhaps grosser and more prevalent irresponsibility is the choice of personal security over global security. And frankly, if you don't have the second, you will lose the first. There's a natural selection process that takes place within this complex. You rise to the top of the military by being pro-military, by advancing military programs, particularly when you have interdepartmental competition, which you do have. The same thing is true in industry. You don't get to be in power positions in industry by saying the defense contract of $40 million is wasteful and that we shouldn't take the contract. For heaven's sake, who are you kidding? Right? They feed each other. These systems feed each other in small ways, in small parts. There is also the self-perpetuating nature of bureaucracy. You don't need to go into that. Everybody sort of understands that. You don't go out there to commit suicide. We have tended to grow over the years and it will continue to grow, I'm sure. Technology is in here. And technology I call morally neutral. And the problem is that in this particular issue, it serves some very diabolical interests. Research and development is a very big thing, very big part of all this. And between 1950 and 1977, between us and the Russians, we managed to spend $338 billion. These are old-fashioned dollars that are worth a lot more than dollars these days. And it would appear, when you look at the history of the arms race and the history of politics, and this is something that Dr. Barnaby, again, stressed very highly. He said that policy follows technology. Essentially, the policy is a rationalization to the system. As soon as something comes online, we are able to do something, we incorporate it in the system, and we try to deploy it. It does incorporate all this fabulous technology. And it is fabulous. I don't deny it for a minute. A good example, I should say that I, in parentheses, after policy follows technology, I've got follows politics. A little bit of a symbiotic relationship there. That's case of tone tail. We decided to put the person keys in Europe, talked about that yesterday, 108 of them, and realized that they were vulnerable. They have to be protected. Well, we think we've got a satellite system that can detect Russian launch. Okay. So you put more money into that, and then you end up with the satellite sitting up there, which within 2 minutes will make a decision without any human intervention, as to whether or not these missiles will be launched, and the satellite pushes the button, in which case it's all over. Okay. One of the most diabolical components in this whole system is one I call nice guys doing a good job. And it's the whole idea of the perception that this is good, that this is right, that this is patriotic, that this is basically the thing to do. And I do it well, and I'm serving my country, and da da da, right on down the line. I don't want to over-emotionalize this, but I believe in reality, it's very close. There are quite well-documented stories of guards in the death camps of Germany who were good parents, good buddies, and that kind of guys you like to have all the brats and beers. You know. They're not evil, sinister people. These people who are participating, there are people like you and I. You're not looking at some outside enemy. It is just the systems and the process which get us into trouble. And going along with them, it's very hard not to do. Look around in the country today. Who is not going along? Hardly anybody. Okay, jumping outside of that complex, back into masses again for a minute. No organized opposition is a motivating factor here. Yeah. They're getting away with it. Yeah. Nobody's jumping up going, this is crazy. You know, you got to stop. We're all going to die. This is nuts. It's a fascinating topic. Worth a couple of hours. And someday, if you get a chance to see anybody deal with that, take them up on it. It's pretty interesting. But at this point, the colleges, the universities, no opposition out of there. The funding for the science department, the chemistry department especially, at the University of Minnesota, I stopped one day and just saw this sort of little thank you plaque. It reads like the list of the top defense contractors in the country. They're all up there. General Dynamics, Honeywell, 3M, right on down the line. These are the people that fund the program. Mm-hmm. The churches have not raised a strong prophetic voice on this issue. There are some small bands of prophets running around who are concerned about it. I've seen in the last couple of years a certain amount of growth. It's positive. I believe with Dr. Anderson, this is good. It should be encouraged. It's up to you, as it's up to us, to bring these things to the attention of our fellow Christians. At this point, there is no organized opposition of any effectiveness coming out of the organized church. The industry is not going to do it. The Pentagon is not going to do it. What an idea. I'm wondering, you know, how many people would like to see an agency of the federal government specifically devoted to arms control and disarmament? Okay? You think that'd be a good idea? Okay, how many people here know that we have one? All right, I'm going to tell you about the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. It exists. It's been in existence for a number of years. It comes under roughly under the State Department, though it is autonomous. When they were put into, when they were chartered, they were chartered with one unusual constraint, I think, and that is that they were not allowed to disseminate their information without request. Now, it's the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in Washington, D.C. They can be reached through the State Department. Okay? Federally funded agency, and the information is excellent. Once you learn it exists and you ask them for it, they'd love to tell you about it. They've got great information on the effects of nuclear war. They've got great information on weapon systems. They go around, more than happy to tell our story, but they can't lobby. They can't present the point of view. The Pentagon lobbies, they're the strongest lobby in the country. I mean, they're just phenomenal. They've got lobbyists for every single congressperson up there, and they're good. They're highly paid. It's an interesting thing. You can get information to your congressman, by the way, by just asking for their annual reports and things like that. They're quite good, very informative. Okay, another thing is passivity. As far as no organized opposition, when we were preparing to do a little action summer on Hiroshima and Nagasaki today, okay, that was August 6th, and while I'm getting ready to do that week, the Gallup poll came out with another major survey, and they found out, in large sample, nationwide, that 20% of the nation felt that we were highly likely to be in a nuclear war within 10 years. Highly likely and highly probable. And 50% of them didn't think they would make it. Rated their chances of survival was 4. Now, I don't have time to get into this very much, but think a little bit for yourselves about why these people are not out in the streets yelling their heads off, or writing their congressman, or electing somebody who's got that point of view, or something. And that's almost as many people as elected Ronald Reagan. It's certainly enough to tip the balance in any election. I like to think a little bit about the analogy of, you know, if you knew that there was a bus coming down the street to hit, you know, and that your child was playing out there in the street, you would do something about it, would you not? Would you just stand there? This is people who believe that this is going to happen. A lot of people do. Are not acting. They're not doing anything about it. That's a big problem. Conformity and blind obedience are two other things that you just can't find in any population that falls out under the bell curve. It's a luxury I do not think we can afford, especially in this system. Okay. Two more factors. One is inertia. It rolls for a while on its own. And we're not all on the same side in this thing. You know, we're pushing the arms race, and then for a while, maybe during the time, we let up a little bit. And the Russians have been busting since, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis to catch up. They've sworn that they'd never be behind again, never go through that kind of humiliation again. And, you know, we wait for a while and nothing happens, and we go, good grief, you know, we got to get back in there. Right? The system itself has got a tremendous amount of inertia. It just keeps itself going. Okay, I'm setting my watch here. It's like about 5 minutes. The final thing I want to talk about a couple minutes is madness. Have you ever heard the phrase, the sanest man in the world? Does that ring a bell with anybody? The sanest man in the world? Okay, this is the Pentagon phrase, and it refers to the two guys who sit in the missile silos in North Dakota and are responsible for launching that weapon. Alright? They each sit there with a pistol, an Army 45, under instruction to shoot the other person if there's any sign of deviant behavior. Alright? While they're resting on a button that has the potential of destroying probably several million people. Okay. Now, to be able to be in that position and maintain maybe a certain kind of sanity, a friend of mine likes to say, what if the crazy guy shoots first? Well, that doesn't seem to be in their contingency plan. They have demonstrated a little game of tying spoons, putting a spoon in a string across both sides of the room and turning it. You can get both switches to go simultaneously. It's this kind of stuff that's going to do it. You know, it isn't a big fancy plot or anything that's going to bring this thing off. It's going to be some quirk that nobody ever imagined, or some lunacy. I like to think of madness as the inability to distinguish reality. In that case, it maybe covers quite a few people in this thing. I like to think about Richard Nixon getting bombed at Camp David with Edie Rebozo, drinking pitchers full of martinis at a time when he was still the President of the United States. Helen Caldicott again points out the effects of frontal lobe tumors on people's behavior. You sit there dormant for years, and all of a sudden, they do very weird things. Things happen on submarines, and among submarine commanders. Caspar Weinberger last summer finally admitted that the submarine could, without any other permission, any authorization, it could launch all their missiles. There is no organic or mechanical link prevent that. So all these guys, the little presidents out there and the little submarines using it, sitting on this awesome type of top. I don't have time to talk about, I didn't think I would, to talk about the war to end all wars and how it's going to start. So I think it's something that you should think about a little bit. I do not have time to talk about what it will be like. Suffice it to say it will be hell. Period. I'd like to leave you with one thought. Let us not grant Hitler a posthumous victory. Thank you very much.